Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
The views and opinions expressed by individuals on the following program do not necessarily reflect those of the network, Guys Guy Radio, and its platforms.
It's Guys Guy Radio. Here's your host, Robert Manny.
Welcome to Guys Guys Radio. This is your host, Robert Manny, welcoming you to the show where men and women can be at their best and everyone wins. Guys Guys Radio. We're here to inform you, inspire you, empower you, get you to think, feel, and who knows, maybe even act by virtue of the journeys, stories, experiences, and insights of the guests I bring you each and every week to the show. And once again, this week is no exception. Today, we're going to talk all about the Grateful Dead. That's right, the Grateful Dead, that American phenomena that's been around since the mid-60s. We have a special guest, his author, Michael Benson. He wrote a book, he's a real deadhead, and he wrote a book called Why the Grateful Dead Matter. And we're going to get into all aspects of how the dead have impacted and cemented themselves into our culture, their music, their live performances, their marketing, if you will, because not only did they bring tie-dye to the forefront, but also they became a real brand different than any other rock band in that their concerts were so special over the years that they allowed bootleg recordings to go on and be distributed. People would exchange dead tapes. They have series after series of live concerts that are available. If you go on iTunes or wherever you get your music these days, you can find so many live recordings of the Grateful Dead. And they went through a number of different periods in terms of their creativity, in terms of their albums. Their three or four first couple of albums were in kind of the psychedelic area. And then all things changed with the more Americana-based acoustic Working Man's Dead. That led into American Beauty, two of the finest American albums of all time. And I think everybody knows a deadhead. Everybody has some friend or is a deadhead who followed the band, who never gets tired of their music. And, you know, it's interesting because our show, Guys Guys Radio, we bring in all different types of guests across the board. And we recently were picked up by UK Health Radio. And we've done a lot of things in terms of putting out information to help people in terms of their wellness and well-being. So you may ask yourself, well, why a show about the Grateful Dead? You know what? The Grateful Dead exuded and communicated really, really positive vibes, mellow, nonviolent, and just kind of cool, laid-back music, a lot of jams, a lot of fun music. And you could say, you know what? Music is part of wellness. So I think we're going to have a good discussion, and if you're a deadhead, you may enjoy it because we're going to get down the rabbit hole on a couple of the issues with the dead. And if you're not and just curious as to, like, why does that friend of mine never stop listening to the dead and keep going to all the different concerts and all the different renditions of the Grateful Dead that have been around? Because as I think most of you know, the Jerry Garcia, who was kind of the front person for the dead and the amazing guitar player, he passed back in 1995, yet the brand itself, if you will, the Dead, is as popular as it's ever been. And now they have other versions of the Dead that still tour with different guest artists who work with them. And it's just an amazing phenomena and part of the American culture. And I consider myself kind of a mini Deadhead, if you will, in that I still listen to their music. I have a playlist with Dead songs. I like them. They always keep me kind of in a good vibe, and they're different than any other band that's out there in so many different ways. And we're going to get into all of that on Guys Guys Radio today with our special guest, once again, Michael Benson. He's written over 60 books. He's a terrific writer located in Brooklyn, New York. And the name of this book is Why the Grateful Dead Matter. And we're going to get into all of that right here on Guys Guys Radio.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
It's Guys Guy Radio.
Okay, Guys Guys Radio, the interview portion of our show, and today we're going to talk about the Grateful Dead. I know there's millions of deadheads out there. Most of them are in the U.S., but their music is all around the world. But the big base of the Grateful Dead is right here in the good old USA. And we're going to learn about that and more from Michael Benson. Michael Benson's been on the show before. He's published over 60 books. He wears a Steal Your Face hoodie. He's attended dozens of Dead shows. I've attended about six or eight. And he still has roots for the Lithuanian basketball team during the Summer Olympics that Bill Walton was supporting. Michael's books include vintage science fiction films, Who's Who in the JFK Assassination, Ballparks in North America. Maybe we've got another show there. Inside Secret Societies, Killer Twins. And also we talked about his book about the Nazis in the United States prior to World War II. And that was our most recent discussion. So why the Grateful Dead is the book we're going to talk about today, and the Grateful Dead itself. And it's a cohesive essay. It's really a terrific book. It answers the titular question, gauging the relevance of the band from a wide variety of angles. The book, it looks at the Dead up close and from afar, in the concrete and the abstract, from the personal to the remote, with immediacy and nostalgia. Michael Benson is an award-winning poet, and he brings the music of the language to his prose. It's a very well-written, fun book to read. He analyzes Dead lyrics with a scholarly awareness of verse and zen. So start right now. Enough of this. Let's bring him out. Michael Benson, welcome back to Guys Guys Radio. How are you, Michael?
Hey, thanks for having me, Robert.
Well, as a subject, I was going through some of your many books, and you write about so many different subject matters, and I saw Dead. The Grateful Dead here. And the name of the book, once again, is Why the Grateful Dead Matter. It came out a few years ago, but it's been endorsed by the Dennis McNally, the Grateful Dead publicist. He says, anyone who acknowledges the inherent validity of someone else's spiritual experience and becoming a deadhead was nothing if not a spiritual transformation will find a fascinating wealth of information in Michael Benson's glorious manifesto. So tell us about, Michael, how you got into the Grateful Dead, and more importantly, what is the Grateful Dead?
Okay. Let me start by saying that a few years back, quite a few years now, Pete Hamill, the newspaper columnist and book writer, wrote a book called Why Sinatra Matters. And it was a beautiful little book, and it wasn't just about Sinatra, the great singer, or a great actor, or about his influence on show business even, but it was about the stamp he put on American culture. He changed what we perceive as cool. He offered Italian Americans a pride and a sense of belonging here in America that they hadn't felt before. So in about 2014, Steve Hull at the University Press of New England decided that it was about time that someone gave the same treatment to the Grateful Dead. To write a beautiful little book. I mean, many books about the Dead are tabletop books. This one you can put in your pocket, you can put in your purse, you can take it to the beach. And it also can rest on the commode because the chapters are short and it's a good place for it.
You don't have to read them in order either. You can just pick up the book and read a chapter.
You can open the book to any page and it'll be fine. But it's not so much about the music, although a large part of it is, but it's also about the permanent thumbprint they put on Western civilization. And the book contains 34 reasons why the Grateful Dead matter. I argued at the time that it should be why the Grateful Dead matters, because it's a single entity. And they answered, it was an academic press. They answered, well, we thought that matter made it more metaphysical. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, okay.
But well, let's put it into context, Michael. You've got the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd, and you've got the Grateful Dead. What the Grateful Dead, very different experience. Their music is different. It went through a lot of different iterations over time, from the psychedelic to the Americana kind of folky, and then into more commercial. They're known for their concerts. Their concerts, they allowed bootleggers to listen to their music. And then with the Dick's Picks and all the others, there's so many live concerts that are being released, and all the other bands have followed suit in that. And the other really interesting thing about the Dead for me is that they really didn't have a hit song until the very end of their career, Touch of Grey. And they've had so many great songs, and it was just an FM phenomena. And even the critics, I remember reading Rolling Stone, and they were reviewing Wake of the Flood, and they said, like, oh, here's the Grateful Dead. They sound like mooing cows, I remember, the vocals on one of the tracks there. And they really had been given a hard time by kind of the industry and also the critics, yet their fans, when you're a Deadhead, you're a Deadhead, and you love what they do, and their experience is different. So talk to us about all of that.
Well, as far as the hit single goes, I think Touch of Grey probably did more damage than good. It brought in a lot of neophytes, and the concerts became something other than what they used to be, which was a celebration, almost a religious experience. Now, suddenly you had kids who were hearing them on the radio showing up and not knowing what to do. You know, you're not supposed to drink too much beer. You're supposed to stay mellow, and you're not supposed to start fights. And there was some of that. And they had sabotaged previous chances to have hit singles. Uncle John's Band could have been a hit single, except for there's a single word in the lyrics that they refused to remove, and it was played on FM only. And I think the key point is that they could not play the same song the same way twice. Human beings, when they tend to make copies, make identical copies, like a Xerox machine. The Grateful Dead, we're more like nature. Nature makes snowflakes. And snowflakes, although from afar they look similar, up close, they're all absolutely unique. And that's the way it was with Grateful Dead shows. You can have 500, I still call them tapes because I'm an old guy, but you can have 500, you know, concerts on your hard drive, and you still want the one you don't have, because it's going to have that moment. That sublime moment that it doesn't appear in any other concert they ever did. You know, I know that, you know, I know my favorite Morning Dew. I know my favorite Wharf Rat. And all of them are great, but there are those that are just, they put you in a place where no other band can put you. I always compared Jerry's playing with Miles Davis. I wish that we could go back in time and have those two put on a show together, because that would have been just incredible. Five times Miles warmed up for the Dead at the Fillmore West, and Jerry was like a sponge. And I rented that historical fact backwards, because I'm listening to a jam on one of my CDs, and I'm going, hey, that sketch is a Spain. You know, and then I look, like, it's called Spanish Jam. Okay. I get it. And not only were the concerts all identical, no two Dead songs seem to have the same roots. It's more like a stew, like a gumbo. They didn't fuse types of music, like jazz and rock and roll. I've heard that fusion music. They didn't do that. They crossbred music, so that songs would come out with little tastes of different ethnicities, different rhythms. And a lot of that has to do with the different interests of the members of the band. They're kind of an eclectic group.
Okay, let's get into that. Let's go back to their beginnings, Michael. San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury, the height of kind of the early, mid-60s, if you will. LSD was still legal at the time, I think, up until 1965. And they had they used to play, and they had a seminal concert, I believe. It was a free concert where they just went down to one of the streets, plugged in, and played, and everybody came, and that, you know, the rest is history. Tell us about their beginnings, who they were, and what led them to that point. Who are these guys?
They came together organically. Jerry was a, that's Jerry Garcia, the lead guitarist. He was a folkie who had an act with his girlfriend. He did Robert Hunter, and he would do, you know, Robert Hunter would play stand-up bass, and Jerry would play banjo. And they were folkies. Phil Lesh was an experimental musician and a classical composer. He had written a symphony for four orchestras with the audience sitting in the middle. I don't think it was ever performed, but an interesting thought. So he introduced to the band the concept of improvisation, which had never occurred to anybody else. Bill was a solid drummer. He was necessary because he had a station wagon, and they carried their entire sound system in Billy's station wagon, which is pretty amazing because, you know, 10 years later, it took multiple trucks and a convoy to get the wall of sound set up for Dead shows, which could then pull complaints for noise from other states. It had Bob Weir. Bob Weir, I guess to put it bluntly, was supposed to be the chick magnet. He was younger and had the longest hair, the mischievous attitude. And he sang, considering the fact that he looked like a woman when he was 18, he sang surprisingly macho songs. He sang cowboy songs and brought Western music into the mix. And then you had Ron McKernan, Pigpen, who was the initial leader of the band. He was a white blues singer, played keyboards, and the initial Dead Jams would be backing up Pigpen and, you know, doing Sadie Mae for 15 minutes or Turn On Your Love Light, usually ended concerts with him up front singing the song. And together, they... their first gigs had to do with psychedelics. A fellow named Ken Kesey, his famous writer, he was putting together these events, experimental events called acid tests.
The Merry and Pranksters, was that him? The Merry Pranksters?
The Merry Pranksters, right. That's where Mountain Girl came from, Jerry's first old lady. And they would ride around on a bus that said Further on front and was psychedelically painted. They came east, but they didn't like the scene. The psychedelic scene was here. Was kind of meh. The college professors had sort of taken over the acid tests in the East Coast. But they out west, Ken Kesey would put on these parties. Everybody would dose when they came in, and there would be lots of strobe lights and different sound and visual things going on. Kesey himself would walk around saying things like, "Stay inside your own movie, stay inside your own movie." And the Dead would come out and they would play. And sometimes they'd play one song that lasted an hour and a half. Sometimes they'd go through, make it through a set. Sometimes, and I suspect this didn't happen that often, but according to Jerry, they would come out, they would play a couple of notes and then drop their instruments and go party with everybody else. And nobody cared. It didn't matter if they were good or not. And it really wasn't until they ran into a fellow named Owsley, who was a rich kid from back east. His had a grandfather was a U.S. senator, who believed in them. He was their first benefactor. He put them up in an apartment in Haight-Ashbury. He paid all the bills and told them that they could be good if they just worked at it. And working at it was a little bit of a struggle at first, but They eventually got a record contract and had a couple of interesting studio.
Yeah, let's talk about
they
that.
Put on.
Let's talk about the albums for a minute. My special guest, Michael Benson, has written the book "Why the Grateful Dead Matter." We're having a conversation. Two deadheads. I'm a mini deadhead. Michael's a real deadhead. I'm much more into the Stones, and I want to do a comparison there. With the albums, what I always found interesting, because I got into the Dead at the end of high school and then in college, and I went back, I heard Working Man's Dead and then American Beauty, and I was hooked. And then I went back and listened to their first three albums, Grateful Dead, Aya Amoxa, what was it?
Aksamoxoa,
and Anthem of the Sun. And I'm like, these are pretty trippy. And they really flipped a switch when they went to their two seminal albums, in my opinion, when they did Working Man's Dead, American Beauty, the Skull and Roses live LP with Bertha that kicked it off, and then Europe 72. So, and then they did some other studio albums that were kind of, in my opinion, they weren't at the same level as those two, Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, which hold up so well. So what happened that made them flip the switch to go from the psychedelic to the Americana music?
Well, I think they were pale, like many of the top musicians of the day. They were pals with Dave Crosby, mm-hmm. recently passed away. And, you know, he said, man, you know, what you got to do is you got to write real songs. And they managed to do that for most of 1970 with Robert Hunter writing lyrics that weren't like China Cat Sunflower and Dark Star. They weren't trippy lyrics anymore. They were telling these stories that seemed to come out of Americana. They came out of a nostalgic world in which the hero was usually down and out. He had a gambling problem often, but he always had time to sit and talk to a bum who said, "Hey, mister, you got a dime?" And I suspect that it was a little bit of Robert Hunter himself showing up in those songs. And Jerry's only rule was, please, Robert, don't write any lyrics. I'm going to feel stupid singing. Mm-hmm. So they were cool. They were cool. They were westerns and honky tonk type songs.
A lot of acoustic too. They went from the psychedelic
and very,
to the
and very pretty. Yeah. And very pretty. And like
and
I said,
singing.
Uncle John's Band could have been a hit single. Yep. I think Truckin' was probably too long to be played on the radio at that point. But they stand up so well. American Beauty and Working Man's Dead are miracles. If they had been a double album, I think we probably would be talking about it as the greatest album of all times. Mm-hmm. As it is, they're both in the top 10.
Yep, I agree.
And and like you, that was my first introduction to the Grateful Dead. I got Working Man's Dead, and then I got American Beauty. And then in 1977, I decided it was between my junior and senior year of college. I was going to go discover America and write the great American novel like Hunter Thompson. And it didn't work out that way. I did write a novel.
You did 60 books, though, so you did pretty darn well, Michael.
That's right.
So
and,
far.
I crossed the country, and I ran into Jerry Garcia for the first time at the Keystone Berkeley, a saloon in Berkeley, California. And Jerry was skinny. He wore black leather. His roadies wore Grateful Dead vests. I remember they said Oakland chapter. And in fact, I showed up early so I could be first in line, and I bought a huge bottle of brandy. And by the time the doors opened, I was out of it. I was completely out of it. But I had befriended and I'd shared the brandy and befriended the Hell's Angels. And, you know, they propped me up and got me in. And then I went inside and passed out in the balcony, at which time my favorite Hell's Angel, a guy named Rick, came over and said, "Hey, little dude, you're going to miss the show." and he laid out a line for me of something that looked like brown sugar. And I snorted it, and I was up for the next 48 hours.
Wow. That's an interesting
So I think that was crank, I think is what they called that.
Did you get a chance to approach Garcia and just say hello or anything?
Oh, no. I was not at my best.
Okay. So let's.
But plus, I was in awe.
Right.
He came out and he played the first set was Sugary.
Wow.
45 minutes. And, you know, by the time he got to the last verse, you know, everybody was just stunned. This was just these tremendous leads going on in between. Finishes the song. He said, "We'll be back in a few minutes." He played one song first set.
Let's talk about that because I think that's really important. I alluded to my being a huge Stones fan. I've seen them like 19 times, and there's the good and there's the not so good when you're a Stones fan to see them live. first of all, they're still at it, and they're playing as good as now as they did when I first saw them, which was Steel Wheels in 1989. Right. And I just saw them a couple of years ago, and they were fabulous. Charlie Watts was still with them. And I was like, wow. And Mick Jagger can still fill up the room. He can still sing. Out of all those, you know, boomer rock guys, he can sing. The others, not so much as good as he can, but his voice is still there. So that's really interesting. But the thing is, when you see the Stones, they have kind of there's an expectation of the audience where they paid big money and they want to hear, you know, Start Me Up and Jumpin' Jack Flash and Paint It Black and Sympathy for the Devil and Gimme Shelter. There's a set of songs that they have to play. Now, they claim that, you know, oh, we do it a little bit different each time, but they really stick to the script there. And then they'll sprinkle in four or five different ones because they have like 400 songs or something. When you see the Dead, they set up, even though they've played some of the same songs over and over again in multiple shows, it seems like what I read in your book, they have a framework. So they really didn't package things, and they would say, okay, here's some of the songs, and it's kind of a skeleton for them. And then they would see what happened because they made it an experience that they were part of. And that's wonderful. And that's real freedom as an artist.
The Grateful Dead always insisted on being creators and performers simultaneously, which is a pressure no other band would put on themselves. The light guy would beg, you know, please tell us what the opening number is going to be, so at least we can get set up. And, you know, Bobby would say, okay, we're going to open with Bertha. And then, you know, they wouldn't. They would go to a different song. And sometimes the way they wove in and out of songs was very odd. There's one concert where they played 17 minutes of Dark Star, and then there was Me and My Uncle. They came out of it into Me and My Uncle, and then the second Me and My Uncle was over, they went into 15 more minutes of Dark Star. I go, what happened there? How did they communicate that to one another that they were going to do that right there, then and there? So, I mean, sometimes you catch them with little hand signals and stuff, but they'll tell you that it's because, you know, they all tripped together thousands of times during the mid-60s, and that they're all on the same astral plane and could read each other's minds musically. And this strikes me as probably not what's happening. But I can't tell you what is happening. I can't tell you how that magic is formed. It's they're alchemists in some way. And they're using instruments that are unique, made of special different kinds of wood. I think Phil at one point had a bass where each string went to a different amplifier, so that if he would hit two notes, one would come over here, one would be over here.
And also they incorporated the as a kind of the third leg of the stool, the audience and their vibe would impact their playing and their creating while they got into their long jams. And from what I read in your terrific book, Michael, sometimes that really worked and sometimes it didn't work as well. And I think further on they got in their career, the toll of the road and the drugs and the life on the road and all that took its toll, if you will.
And, well, yeah, I mean, it was always a risk. I mean, you were talking about the high prices of Stones tickets and the expectations of the audience.
Right.
Deadheads really came in tabula rasa, because some nights the Dead were just going to kind of fall apart and noodle for a couple of hours. It didn't always work. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel sorry because last time I went to see Dead and Company, I sat with a group of Gonzaga University law students who were traveling with the band for the summer. It's a Citi Field in Queens, New York. And they were stunned, first of all, that I'd seen Jerry in person. That made me special. I forgot where I'm going with this now.
Gonzaga students.
The Gonzaga students were... They were taking tremendous numbers of drugs. I couldn't comprehend. I think I took one hit off of the joint I was stoned for a couple of days, but then they're just blasted. All the conversation is about which song's going to seg into which song. And they're totally into the Dead and Company world, which struck me as, and I had a hard time explaining this to them, that Jerry Garcia, when he was doing Stella Blue, could bring this stadium to complete silence and then make them explode. And I said, I'm sorry, you know, John Mayer is a really good guitar player.
He is.
And I mean, he's just tremendous, you know, rock god. But he can't cast the spell that Jerry could. And that night, O'Teal, the bass player for Dead & Company, sang Comes a Time. And Mayer, of course, played the lead. And there were some, and when it was over, it was really, really good. And when it was over, I heard somebody in a nearby seat go, "That was Church, man." and I turned to the guys from Gonzaga and I said, "Well, that was close."
Yeah.
But it took two guys.
Okay.
Jerry would have done that by himself.
All right, let's talk about that. Two guys. Okay. We're two guys here. Robert Manny, host of Guys Guys Radio, Michael Benson. We're talking about the Grateful Dead and Michael's terrific book, Why the Grateful Dead Matter. So talking about two guys, it seems like every band, you've got two front people. You got Lennon and McCartney. You got Jagger and Richards. You got Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir. Very different, very talented. Jerry's a virtuoso on the guitar. We're good, not in the same league in terms of or style, but he brings his earthiness. He brings the cowboy music, the Western Americana. And what I found most interesting in reading your book is they both had their own lyricists, and there was issues with that. And you know, when you have Lennon and McCartney or Jagger Richards, you know, they write their own, you know, they go back and forth with the lyrics. Maybe Keith will have like Start Me Up and then Jagger fills it in or something. And Lennon and McCartney went back and forth, but with Garcia and Weir, they had their own lyricists, and sometimes there was some friction because of that between particularly Bob Weir and Robert Hunter. Is that correct?
Robert Hunter at one point refused to write any more words for Bob Weir to sing because, well, Bob Weir, a dyslexic fellow, he plays his rhythm guitar inside out. I mean, it's hard to understand quite what Bob Weir is doing, but when he's not there, they don't sound like the Grateful Dead anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever he's doing, it's absolutely the essential part of the mix, but it's hard to figure it out because no other rhythm guitarist would play it that way. He has trouble remembering lyrics. I remember the first time I saw the Grateful Dead was at Englishtown, and I don't think Bob got through an entire song without forgetting the lyrics at one point or another. My joke, I think, in the book was they played Truckin' 500 times live and Bob got the words right four. and when he would do this, or else, when he would forget, he would fill in what every singer does when they forget the words. They fill in with other words and make things up as they go along. And it just drove Robert Hunter nuts. And he
got his own, Weir got his own.
They got Barlow, yeah.
Barlow. And then they did this terrific album, Ace, which to me is just as good as any Grateful Dead album in there. It's, and the 50th anniversary just came out. I was listening to the remix, tremendous remix. Unfortunately, when you listen to the live version of it that was recorded recently, you know, you can see the difference. The age has set in there on his voice. He's still, you know, listen, he's a tremendous guitar player, rhythm guitar player. He plays his own style. I guess my question was, how is he different from Jerry, and how do they make that work, and why do they have their own lyricists? You just explained that.
Well, Robert Hunter wouldn't work with Bobby Weir anymore, so Weir had to get his own lyricist.
But why did they go to the outside in the first place?
I guess because they couldn't.
Okay.
Not everybody can write in words.
Mm-hmm. And Hunter's fabulous.
Burt Bacharach needed Hal David. Mm-hmm. Elton John needed Bernie Taupin.
Right, I got you.
I think that lyricists are part of show business tradition. The fact that Lennon McCartney did both and that Jagger Richards did both, pretty stunning. I mean, that's not that usual. The King songs, I don't think there are any collaborations ever. Right.
So with Jerry and Weir, in terms of writing, songwriting as a band, I know Truckin' was a group effort and it took a long time. The other songs, though, where did they come from? Because they had separate lyricists, did one person write the melody? Another one came up with kind of the underpinning or the chords or the rhythm? Or how did Weir and Garcia work together, if they did work together, in terms of song craftsmanship?
They did it through practice. And I don't mean practice as in rehearsal, but as they would play a song the first time and it would be bare bones. Mm-hmm. And then each time they played it, and they would play it live in front of people. I mean, all these experiments are happening right out there. Their rehearsals would be little snippets of songs. They would never make it all the way through anything. They would do their working on songs to figure out the spaces in between the notes, what to do, how to fill. They would do that during a show, and these songs grew as they toured, which is why the series of albums, the studio albums that weren't that good during the 80s, and I guess it was during the 80s. Bob Weir says that the reason they're not good is because we had just written those songs. I mean, Fire on the Mountain is on a studio record, and it kind of lays there. But by the time they get to Cornell, and they're sagging it out of Scarlet Begonias, it turns into this fantastic piece of almost classical music.
Yeah.
But it's down the road. They had developed it to that point.
That's a great point, Michael, because other bands, whether by they have to do it or the record companies are forcing them into it, but they'll come out with an album and then they kind of walk them out on the road and they test out the songs and they sometimes change, but they packaged it already and it's done. Whereas the Dead would put the song out there and play it live and let it breathe and then learn about it and then create it as a studio recording. I think that's brilliant and unique.
Yes. Well, and the other thing that about the Dead that I thought was interesting is they said that once the music was in the air, it belonged to everybody. Mm-hmm. The notion of this is proprietary didn't occur to them. Tapers were always allowed.
Yeah.
The formal taping section, to explain to those who never were at a Grateful Dead concert, there was a section in the middle of the hockey arena or the stadium that was reserved for tapers. And they would put microphones on the top of tall poles, and there would be this section with just a sea of microphones sticking up, and everybody was taping the show. And I don't think they sold the tapes. They traded tapes. People would trade tapes so that they would be able to hear concerts they weren't able to be at. And the whole notion of allowing that, it was expanded also the fan base.
So great.
And they ended up getting mad rich anyway.
Right. Well, the other thing that people forget, tie-dye. Tie-dye is mainstream now. The Grateful Dead started tie-dye, right?
Bobby Weir picked up a hitchhiker on the way to his ranch. The guy had invented the tie-dye technique. He said, you know, can I spend the night? Can I sleep in your barn? Sounds like the beginning of a joke. Can I sleep in your barn? Sure, but you got to chop wood for me. So the guy was a good worker, so he hung out for a while. And pretty soon, you know, Bob says, what are you doing with that sheet? And he, that's really cool. And the first public exposure of tie-dye were sheets that the Dead would put over their speakers and as backdrops on their stages. And I think probably the next thing that happened would, you know, women were wearing dresses that were tie-dyed and they would spin in them. And now every summer camp has tie-dye day. It's part amazing. Of an American tradition.
Let me ask you a couple more questions because sure. I want to get them all in here. Two drummers. Yes. I always found it fantastic that the Dead had two drummers because for their type of music, I was thinking, well, why do they really need two drummers? Yet it worked and it was seamless. Tell us about why they made that decision.
Well, I'm not sure that it was ever a decision. Bill Kreutzmann was the drummer for the Dead, and he met a guy named Mickey. And Mickey and Bill, I think the first 24 hours that they knew each other, they just went around drumming on things, and they realized that their brains were kind of in sync with one another. So Bill says, you know, guys, would be okay if Mickey sits in on a show. And he did. And of course, the results were really good right away. And after the show, Jerry says, "That's the Grateful Dead."
Nice.
And Mickey was around for a while, and then his dad became manager and ran off with the gold. They wrote, he's gone about him, steal the face right off your head. And Mickey was mortified. They didn't blame him for what his dad had done, and they didn't hold him responsible or even, you know, but Mickey quit. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Couple of deaths. So there's been a number of deaths in the virtual in the various renditions of the Grateful Dead, the teammates, if you will. So talk about Pigpen, what that meant when Pigpen passed. He's basically died at the magical age of 27, like so many other rock stars.
I can't even believe that he was only 27.
And then Jerry, what happened when both of those guys passed in terms of the trajectory of the band?
Well, when Pigpen died, he was still, you know, the heart and soul of the band, but he was also borderline obsolete. They had moved on to more complicated music. They were using new keyboard players. The God Show came in and was playing more complicated things that Pigpen couldn't play. They were all of the music experimentation was kind of lost on Pigpen to begin with. So the difference was, I mean, they were very sad. Everybody was very sad when Pigpen died, but to a certain extent, it opened up the Grateful Dead to doing the kinds of experimentation for which, you know, the great bulk of their fame came. When Jerry died, the Grateful Dead died. I mean, that was it.
1995. I remember I was working at an ad agency.
I will never forget.
Somebody walked by and said, "Jerry Garcia just passed," and everything went silent.
I was at Yankee Stadium, and they put it on the scoreboard. And again, yeah, stadium silence. And I was kind of stunned because the baseball crowd, I'm at a Yankee game, but everybody went, oh,
yeah.
And in San Francisco, slowly but surely a party started, and Golden Gate Park was filled with hippies in tribute. They lowered the San Francisco city flag from the Civic Center in San Francisco, and they put up a flag that was tie-dyed. Mm-hmm. And everybody awesome. and flew it at half mast. And everybody looked at that and they knew who that was for. So it was stunning and sad. It took a long time, I think, for the Dead to regroup. And I absolutely know Grateful Dead fans will never, ever go see a show by Further or the Wolf Brothers. I'm not going to go to Dead and Company. And as long as Jerry remains in perpetual rehab, I'm not going. But it's kind of sad because it's like saying I'm never going to listen to Beethoven because Beethoven's right. dead.
Let me ask you this, Michael. As a sure. you're a real Deadhead, a true Deadhead, what is your take on what happened after Jerry passed and then they kind of broke up, kind of got back together for some reunion stuff? They had the Other Ones and some other renditions mm-hmm. of them. They're still out there. Every year it seems like there's some version of them that's touring. The mm-hmm. Dix Picks, all those live performances that are well recorded are being released constantly. The Dead is really a brand now. Probably they never expected that, but it seems like they've done it in a way that, to me, it's very acceptable. I don't like, oh, they sold out. I don't feel that at all. I'm curious about you as a Deadhead. What do you think about all of that? And what do you think about the music now and how they're playing? Is this like a Dead show? And you mentioned your concert at Citi Field. Mm-hmm. What was that like, knowing that you had seen them when they were the really raw beginning Dead?
It's disappointing. I guess when you start telling your neighbors in the stands about the magic that used to be, it implies the magic's not there anymore. And that said, I thought that the Dead and Company show was really good. I mean, the drums in space was absolutely apocalyptic. Having O'Teal as the bass player rather than Phil made it less like the Grateful Dead, but more like hit singles that you can dance to. I mean, they did a version of Cold Rain and Snow that I said, well, you know, they should just put this out as a single right now. This is top 10 material. But yeah, I think Beethoven's probably a good analogy that a really good piano player and a really good orchestra playing Beethoven is a perfect tribute to Beethoven's genius.
Okay.
You can't say, well, Jerry's gone. Jerry's music is gone as well. It's not. I mean, it's never going to be quite the same. And luckily we have hundreds and hundreds of recordings of Jerry playing. But if you want to go out and have a Grateful Dead experience with somebody else playing lead guitar with these guys, go have fun. Having mm-hmm. fun's the key thing.
Okay. Rapid fire. A couple more questions and we'll wrap up.
Yep.
Okay. Michael Benson, my special guest on Guys, Guys Radio. The book is Why the Grateful Dead Matter. Okay. You're a real Deadhead. Best album.
Best album is American Beauty. Perhaps the best album of all time.
Okay. Best song.
My favorite is Sugary.
Sugary. And that's a solo. And that's another interesting point about the Dead is that where you have a band like the Stones, they won't play any solo material. The Dead welcome solo material.
Oh, all of Ace immediately became Grateful Dead.
Yep.
It was only just Bob Weir for days.
Why, you know, without going down the rabbit hole, why did Garcia make his Garcia album and Weir make Ace when they're kind of like Dead albums? Why didn't they just do them together?
I can't answer that question. I think that, as is true of all groups, sometimes you kind of get tired of being in the same room all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And to get out and work with other people is a nice breath of fresh air. And then they took the best of what they created separately and they brought it back home to the family.
Got it. Okay. Best live album.
Best live album. Oh, well, Skull and Roses. I mean, is still traumatic. I also like Live Dead because the first time I ever heard Dark Star was on that.
Okay. Best of the Dick's Picks.
Well, it is Dick's Picks, Englishtown.
Okay.
I'm not sure what number it is. I also like, Crimson, Red, and Blue. It was Philadelphia, July 7th, 1989.
Okay. Final words for our listeners out there who may not be as familiar as you are, or maybe I am, about the Dead. What would you tell them? Why should you check out the Grateful Dead beyond everything they learned from this interview?
Listening to the Grateful Dead is a therapeutic experience. If you are stressed, and everybody is, and if you're fed up with the modern world, you can listen to Grateful Dead, and it's not only takes you to a place where there's nothing left to do but smile, 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 but it takes you to a timeless place where you're no longer old, you're no longer young. Everybody's in the same boats floating around on a really, really nice plane. And I'm not sure that other bands can do that for you.
Fantastic. Michael, great chat. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Robert.
What's your website for everybody out there to check out your many books?
I don't have a website. I'm at author Michael Benson, all one word, author Michael Benson. And with that, you'll get me to Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff.
Fantastic. Great job. We'll see you again soon, I hope.
Thanks, Robert. Take care.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It's Guys, Guy Radio.
What a terrific and fun conversation with Michael Benson, the author of Why the Grateful Dead Matter. We really got into it and had a lot of fun. We covered the music, we covered the concerts, we covered all the recordings and their cult following and the brand itself, the Grateful Dead. So what did we learn? I think we learned that the Grateful Dead is part of our culture, American culture. They're definitely an American band. Their popularity is squarely here in the United States, although they've toured all over the world and they had a big tour, the Europe 72 tour that many consider them at the height of their creative powers and playing. It was a triple album back then, as I recall. They're still considered an American phenomenon where people followed them around concert to concert. You would go for a summer and say, I'm going to follow the band wherever they go and camp out. And I've seen that. Even living in New York City, I remember living on 34th Street and we had a parking lot behind my building. And when the Dead played a set of shows at the Garden, Madison Square Garden, the deadheads would be camped out behind my building for right through four, three or four nights to make sure that they were going to catch all the shows. And everybody has a story about the Grateful Dead or a friend who likes the Grateful Dead or what happened at a Grateful Dead show, because there was a lot of smoke in the air back in the days where people could light up during the concerts. And there was a lot of people dropping too. And I got to tell you something, honestly, I've only passed out once in my life. And it was during a long jam at a Grateful Dead show at the Spectrum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, when I was a college student. I remember I was a freshman, and about three or four of my friends and I, we wanted to go. We got tickets to the Dead show at the Spectrum, and there was a senior, this guy we knew, for whatever reason, he kind of took us under his wing, and he said, "I'll drive you guys to the Dead show." And it was about a half-hour ride from Villanova into the city, and when we were in the car, he threw a plastic bag back to us. I was in the back seat and some rolling papers. And he said, "You guys want to ride? Get onto this and don't stop till we get there." So stupid us, we did. And by the time we got there, we were pretty zonked out. And then we got to the concert, and it was a dance concert. So what that was in the Spectrum, which was kind of like a Madison Square Garden, a big arena, it was in the winter, they had like hockey season, so they would cover the hockey rink with just some boards and stuff, but no seats. So people would wander around, and it was perfect for a Dead concert. And I remember during one of their long jams, and we talked about their jams and how they created each one differently, and they went in all different directions, but all of a sudden, I found myself on my back looking up, somebody looking down at me, a whole crowd around me, "Hey man, you doing all right?" And I shook it off and I got up. I'm like, wow, I think I went and got a beer to wash away the dry throat and everything else that I was experiencing. And that was one crazy night, because the guy who brought us to the concert, he left us there. So we had to find our way back in a very creative way, which is a whole other story. Back to Villanova University. So back in the day, and I'm sure my buddies, if they're listening to the show, they remember that night, and they remember the cab ride back, and they remember what happened when we got back to campus. It was crazy. So anyhow, Guys Radio, we're here every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Pacific time on KCAA Radio. And then we're on UK Health Radio now four times over the weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So Guys Radio, I'm here for you every week. Thank you. I'm going to see you next week. And until then, like I always like to say, guys, finish first.